Hey everyone, it's your host Richie Burke, and welcome back to the Go Getters Podcast. I am here with Stephen Olakara, who is becoming our resident political expert here on the Go Getters Podcast. Very excited to have him. We're sitting down. It is the evening of Tuesday, November 10th, exactly 1 week after election night. And we're going to break down. We're going to recap what happened and what is going to happen, because this thing could be far from over in a number of ways. It is far from over in a number of ways. So we're going through that. We just overcame a power outage here at GGMM. We're going through a storm right now. So hopefully we make it through this entire podcast. I think we're almost in the clear, but all good here in the studio. Stephen, thanks for joining me today.
Hey, Richie, great to be here. Honored to be back on.
Yes. And for those of you who don't know Stephen, we did an election preview episode a few weeks ago. May not be too relevant listening to it now, but Stephen is the host of the Meeting in Middle America podcast, which he does in partnership with UW Milwaukee and WISP Politics. He is the founder of the Millennial Action Project, whose mission is to activate young leaders to bridge the partisan divide and transform American politics. He's done a lot of amazing work on a national scale through that organization, and he was Forbes 30 Under 30 list back in 2017 for law and policy. And there seems like there's a bunch of legal ramifications of this election right now. So between his political experience with Millennial Action Project and being very intelligent in the law and policy arena as well, I'm more than excited to have you back right now.
Awesome. Well, great to be here. And lots happened since we've last spoken.
Yeah, dude, it was not that long ago at all. So What was your initial reaction on election night?
Well, I had a couple reactions. One in the short term is, as a number of people were starting to predict, that Trump might not concede the race, and that has an impact on norms as we think about the transition of power. I also was watching the absentee ballot counting very closely. Millennial Action Project, as you referenced, my organization had been very active in strengthening the voting systems in key battleground states, including Wisconsin, to make sure that we can have a successful election in a pandemic. And I was very proud to see that a number of the improvements we've seen put in place since April really did make an impact, where people had gotten absentee ballot requests in the mail for registered voters. And a lot of people had become, I think, more familiar with how absentee voting works. And also, the protective equipment that was available for in-person voting was greatly enhanced. And then what I was happy to see is that the counting of now 2 million absentee ballots, which is a record for Wisconsin, were counted in about 24 hours. And that's why Wisconsin had called the race relatively early compared to some of the other swing states. Longer term, I think you look at our political culture, you look at the polarization and the divisions in our democracy. And I think this election season demonstrates that it is an unsustainable trend, and we really do need a change of how we do our politics.
You bring up that you made changes in Wisconsin to make the process better, opposed to, I'm guessing, a Georgia, Pennsylvania, and Arizona, Nevada, which has Nevada even been called?
Yeah, some news organizations have called
some it for news Biden. But yeah, that was lingering forever. I see there's still a bunch of votes out in Alaska. Like, what did Wisconsin do that those states haven't done? I'm actually kind of surprised to hear that different states are doing different things. Although we did know that some laws were different going into this, like Wisconsin can't count absentees till election night, whereas Florida was awesome. That was fun to watch on election night, that we got all those votes in like an hour, and you're like, oh, what's going to happen here? Yeah. And, you know, what those other states were still wondering in a case.
Yeah. And one thing to highlight with that is the pre-processing of absentee ballots has bipartisan support. You wouldn't necessarily know it if you read the news all the time, but our coalition here in Wisconsin, we have a bipartisan group of young state lawmakers who are part of the Wisconsin Future Caucus who support the pre-processing of absentee ballots. We announced it on a news conference just before the election. And I'm hopeful that early next year, as we continue to live in a pandemic and continue to run elections in these unusual times, that bill will get passed.
So what do you feel about all these lawsuits going on right now saying the voting is unfair?
Well, I think a couple things. So first, here in Wisconsin, the final result was within a percentage point. And there is a state law that authorizes recounts when it is that close. And so I think it's totally legitimate to do a recount. However, I don't think it's going to change the result of the election. I think it was, we haven't seen any major irregularities really. And I think the elections administrators generally did a good job. So I don't think there'll be any change.
No, and even Scott Walker, I believe he tweeted out or came out after and said in the two previous recounts, I believe the votes were moved by like 30 votes and then 130 or 150 votes. So very minuscule. And yeah, I'm looking at it right now and it looks like Biden is up by 20,040 votes. So a lot would have to go wrong to flip that.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's right.
What about, can you speak to, I mean, Pennsylvania is a big one that Trump is really going after. He held that amazing press conference at Four Seasons, the Total fancy. Landscaping.
The best Four Seasons.
So what are your views on Pennsylvania?
Well, I think, I mean, again, Wisconsin did our election better than Pennsylvania. They're obviously taking a much longer period of time, but still, I think what election administrators have said there is they're taking extra time to ensure that they have fully 100% accurate results. And so far, there haven't been any substantial reports of fraudulent ballots and irregularities. But again, there is a legal process if they want to investigate that. And there are deadlines that they have to meet, including the electors who formally choose the next president. That has to happen. So we'll see what happens. But I don't think there will be a change in the election. I think what is more important about these lawsuits in Pennsylvania and other states is how much traction they're gaining in our tribal media ecosystems that we have. And this was fully predictable, of course, going into this election. We knew that if Trump didn't win, there would likely be a number of allegations. And again, in this world of Twitter, social media, and fractured media outlets that really just cater to their own base and not trying to have a full conversation, we predicted that those questions about the legitimacy of the election would gain steam. And that has a long-term impact on the next president, assuming it's Biden, because there will be a legitimacy and credibility gap that's really hard to close because of that.
Are the people questioning the legitimacy, is that, you know, it seems just to be Trump's hardcore base. It doesn't seem like even a lot of the Republicans in power are really, you know, getting after it. You see certain ones doing it. You see others that have congratulated Biden. Do you think since Trump is such a polarizing figure and he's such a win at all costs, I believe even if it means, you know, cheating or playing a very dirty game, which I'm not saying Trump's the only politician that does that, but do you think if you take him out of the equation that makes it better in the future? I just look back at basically any other political election, Republican and Democrat, and you've never seen anyone behave like this before.
No, this is unusual. I mean, you'd have to go back pretty far. I mean, I think this is the first time certainly in modern political history that we've had the news organizations call the election and the losing candidate not concede the race. And now that has an impact on the transition as well, because there are official mechanisms that it's called the General Services Administration within the federal government needs to do, that needs to activate in order for the transition to even start. And that isn't happening. And all of us as citizens of this country end up losing if our federal government is not prepared to function well. So that's very unfortunate.
So if Trump refuses to leave, because he's still claiming he won the election and that he won by a lot, which isn't true. Or he said he won by, you know, 70 million legal votes. So did Joe Biden get zero legal votes? And it's really weird because, you know, if the election was rigged, the Republicans probably wouldn't have performed as well as they did in the House and the Senate races. Like, they were all on the same fucking ballot, you know, and they overperformed in those.
That's right. Well, just to highlight your earlier point about some of the Republicans in Congress, you know, you're not seeing all of them kind of dig into the trenches with Trump on this issue. And when you talk to them privately, it's pretty clear that they're preparing for a Biden presidency. But there's a difference between Republicans in Congress and Republicans who are in our communities. And the fact is that Republicans in our communities are still paying attention to what President Trump is saying. And I do have lines of communication into both worlds, both the Democratic world and Republican world. And then I guess the third world would be just disillusioned independents as well. But I know a number of people personally who are taking what President Trump says seriously. But again, from a transition of government standpoint, those Republican senators will have a big impact. And they're, I think, ready to transition.
Okay, so what percentage of the people who voted for Trump do you think agree with his behavior right now? Because I know a number of Republicans that are my friends who did vote for Trump, but they're telling me they don't agree with what he's doing.
Yeah, that would be an interesting poll. I don't know. I mean,
do you think it's 50-50 or do you think it's like 10-20% of them are really behind what Trump is doing right now, alleging fraud and claiming he won and all this other stuff? But obviously that's an extremely vocal majority in it, or minority, if you want to call it a minority, and it's an extremely polarizing one, and they rile people up.
Yeah. Too hard to tell. It's a good question. I think maybe after a couple of months, there might be some better information on what percentage of Republicans believe that the election was stolen or not. And I guess that would be an important piece of information for our democracy over the next few years.
Because, I mean, you got to give Trump a lot of credit in the fact that he does have right now 71,500,000 plus votes. Like, he brought people out. His rallies were packed. Like, I don't agree with Trump's behavior and how he acts, but I give him credit on that. I think he has a very good campaign team, an insanely good marketing team that stoops to pretty low levels, but they know what they're doing and they're amazing at it. And the guy, I mean, he's up there. He's an obese, almost 80-year-old, and he's doing 7 rallies a day. Like, yeah. I give him credit for doing that. It's pretty amazing, actually.
Yeah, it is remarkable. I do believe in the day leading up to election night, he did 5 rallies in one day. And then, of course, he basically pulled an all-nighter on election night. And he came out and did that press conference. I mean, you got to give it to him. He does have a lot of energy. But you're exactly right that, you know, the polls were, you know, tightening in the days leading up to the election. And over 71 million people voted for him. Here in Wisconsin, I looked at the data, Trump added to his vote total compared to 2016. And so, you know, so we have to, Andrew Yang had a great line a couple days, I think, after election night. He said, anytime 70 million Americans do something, you should pay attention to it.
Yeah, 100%. Speaking of the polls, you brought that up. That's a good segue. I mean, they missed the mark by a lot this year. They had the blue wave coming, the Democrats really cleaning up in House and Senate races, and Biden just winning by a landslide. In Wisconsin specifically, they had him winning by 11 points. As we said earlier, he's less than 1 point, which is in fair recall territory, which is much different from 11. What happened?
So the national polls were much more favoring Biden than our state level polls. I still think the best poll available for Wisconsinites is the Marquette Law School poll. They were showing still a Biden victory of, I think, about 4 or 5 points the week before the election. But then when you look at the Washington Post ABC News poll, that showed Biden winning by 17 points. So they were way off. And even the Marquette Law School poll was a little bit too optimistic for Biden. But I guess I would say two things to that. One is that I think some of the national pollsters still don't know how to model the electorate of the Midwest. And that, I think, just further underscores some of the divide that exists between the Midwest and the coasts, because now for 2 presidential cycles, they've gotten it quite wrong. But there is a second dynamic, a little bit that would maybe help to defend a little bit of the Marquette Law School poll, which is to say that there is shifting. I think polls in some ways are snapshots in time. And we saw in the week leading up to Election Day a tightening of the race, and you started to see a number of independent voters swing towards Trump. So even between the last polls we saw and Election Day, I was expecting to see a significant tightening. But again, I'm a supporter of, I was kind of cracking a joke with some of my, with some friends the other day. I was saying I support term limits for elected officials, but we might need some term limits for these political analysts and pollsters as well.
Yeah, I agree. What do you think Trump did so well to close the gap at the end? I kind of touched on how his campaign team, how he hustles so hard, how I think they have, you know, they have marketing that hits people on a very, very emotional level and moves people that way. And then I was sitting around with some friends, it was probably like 2 weeks ago, and there's probably like six of us, and one of them is a hardcore Democrat, and he had voted, I'm independent, voted both ways, but I was decided on Biden. And then the other three guys, where one voted for Jogerson because he didn't like either of the candidates. And then the other two, who I thought would have voted for Biden in this, they were still very undecided. And they said, you know, even their, like their dads, who are typically Republicans, they do not like Trump, but they still voted for him because they were more afraid of Kamala taking over opposed to Biden, thinking he wouldn't last that long. And that would, you know, bring about socialism, whether that's correct or incorrect.
Yeah, well, I think Republican talking point about Biden and Kamala being a bridge to a radical socialist takeover did seem to gain ground in a number of areas. Of course, Biden's response was, hey, I beat those socialists during the primary. Like, I'm not one of them. Now, well, you know, but that said, I think if Democrats were to, or potentially still could, get a majority in the Senate, you could see a number of, you could see the Democrats potentially overreach. So we'll see. But I think what did close the gap? I think, I mean, the Trump campaign has always had a very good digital game. And as you mentioned, Trump was pretty relentless in the final days of campaigning. But I do think there's also, kind of along the lines of what you heard, I heard as well, that some of my friends who did support Trump wanted to stick with the devil they knew instead of the devil they didn't know. And that might have been part of it. But I also think people are generally just still very fed up with the political class and still want, you know, I once heard a Republican political analyst say that, you know, Americans still want blood on the ground, and kind of suggesting that Trump would do well. So, you know, could be any number of those things.
Well, it's just simply human nature that in times of chaos, which this pandemic has been, in times of chaos and uncertainty, people don't like change at all.
Yeah.
And even though a lot of people do view as Trump as chaos, which he can be very erratic, as we've all seen, that's still change bringing someone like Biden in. And you touched on it right. Like, yeah, a lot of people don't like the political, quote unquote, political establishment and kind of how bloated it was. And I think I touched on this last episode. Like, one of the reasons why I voted independently and ended up voting for Gary Johnson in the last one was, you know, Hillary kind of perfectly represented that. And even though I thought Trump was a complete buffoon and not a very good candidate, I liked the fact that he was kind of a disruptive business guy, anti-establishment guy who could maybe go in and shake things up and make some change. And I think he has to an extent. I just don't like the way that he's kind of represented the country and the rhetoric that he's set. But anyway, I liked that about him, and that kind of caused me not to vote for either of them and essentially throw my vote away to Gary Johnson in that case.
Yeah, and we still see a rising, a growing amount of Americans who identify as independent, and you see that disproportionately among millennials. So it will be very interesting to see over the next few years if the parties can kind of get their act together and actually respond to the needs of the American people, or if something else happens.
Because do you think, in my point of view, I mean, I think the left has gone so far left, the right has gone so far right. Like, I would love a down the middle type of candidate. Do you think there's any chance that there could be a legitimate independent candidate? And I know you've talked to my dad. He was on your podcast and we had him on here for a Presidential Playbook episode. And he thought about running, which I would have been fully supportive of him. I don't know if I personally would have liked that, because running for election is an absolute shit show. But he thought about it, but he decided not to, because, you know, he's friends with a lot of smart people in that world and they told him he would have no chance as an independent. Do you see that changing in the next 4 years, 8 years, 20 years ever?
Yeah, I could see that changing potentially in the next 10 years or so. And I think in 10 years, one, you'll see millennials and then Generation Z become a bigger force in politics. But secondly, that's where I could potentially see a true breaking point where, again, right now, if you look at especially Congress, and you see this in some state legislatures, often there's a greater incentive to leave an issue unresolved on the ballot than to actually resolve it constructively. And the thinking behind that is, if we keep this issue on the ballot, then we can continue to gin up and turn out our voters, get them angry at the other side. We profit politically, but also, you know, financially. So as long as that incentive exists, you're going to continue to see this widening disenchantment in the country. And that's where potentially in the next 10 years, you could see a bigger disruption to the parties. But I think if there is a new type of force, you know, within the parties, like we saw in the progressive era here in Wisconsin in the early 20th century, that happened within the Republican Party, massive reforms and anti-corruption and trying to make democracy work better. That's where that was the era where the whole states are the laboratory of democracy phrase kind of got going. Then you could see Americans feeling better about the parties that are available to them. But we'll see.
Where do you think the Republican Party goes from here? Like, who do you think the next candidate is?
Well,
I'm watching Trump and Eric Trump and all those guys on stage, and it's just like I'm just like shaking my head, almost laughing. And like, do you think it's that type of candidate, or do you think it reverts back to like a Mitt Romney or George Bush, who I would have voted for over Biden in this election?
Yeah, that's some people call that Republican classic. Well, I don't know. I often say through Millennial Action Project's work, I get a little window into what the future of our politics will look like, because I'm working with those young leaders who will be shaping the future of our politics. They're in elected office, they're rising stars, they have a very successful political career ahead of them. And when I look at the millennial Republicans and Generation Z Republicans we're working with, I see what I think could be the future of the Republican Party, which is generally believing in small government and free enterprise and lower taxes, but don't have this. They generally believe that, you know, the increasing racial diversity of our country is fine. It's a good thing. A number of them are people of color. They don't deny the science on climate change. They're pro environment. They're pro LGBT rights. And so basically, it's this idea that, you know, they still have conservative principles, but also have an eye towards the future of what the country will look like.
Yeah. And I mean, that sounds refreshing to me, because I identify with a number of the kind of Republican principles that you were talking about. But, you know, climate change is a big issue, even something like gun control, which most Americans support gun background checks. I'm not telling people to abolish guns, but like they should go through a thorough testing before they get that. And like, yeah, women's rights, LGBT rights, which I don't feel, you know, are supported with a guy like Pence being the vice president, and even some of the rhetoric that Trump sense. But I remember joking on the last podcast, like Trump was asked about climate change on the last debate. And his answer was he was going to plant some trees, and he talked to the head of a forest nation. It's like, dude, you're the president of the United States and you can't make up a better answer to combat climate change than you're planting trees? Like,
that's when you lose millennials. That's when you lose the future.
Yeah, he had already lost me long before that, but that was just like, you cannot make up anything better than that. Come on, buddy.
And we've been seeing this, and another study came out recently showing a pretty healthy majority of millennial Republicans under the age of 50, in fact, so even beyond the millennial demographic, believe we need to take action on climate change.
Hey everyone, it's your host Richie Burke, and like all of you, we've had to adapt during COVID. We've had to adapt our business and pivot and adjust a little bit, and what that's meant for us has been creating these online trainings. So we've created a couple podcast trainings, How to Profit Through Podcasting and The Pod Playbook, which are both available on our website, ggmm.io, for anyone who's interested in starting a podcast or growing their current show. They're great for individuals as well as companies. And what I wanted to tell you about today is we just launched a new marketing workshop specifically for small business owners. A lot of small businesses have trouble communicating and generating leads online. What we've done is really simplified it. So we go over the reasons why people buy, how to do market research without the fluff and really get to know your customers efficiently. We go over our storytelling formula, so how to tell a great brand story and how that applies directly to your website. So your website is structured and optimized for conversion and has the elements that it needs on it, as well as how to create great social content and how to set up a basic value ladder and sales funnel for your business. So if you work for a small business, if you are a small business owner, make sure to check this out. We have a launch special going on right now. You can get it for $50 off. It's only $47. Head to ggmm.io/ignite. ggmm.io/ignite. Thanks for joining us again today. Let's get back to the show. Let's go over to the younger Democrats then. Yeah. I think some people might be listening and thinking like younger Democrats are all socialists or right. Or what that is. Are they or are they not? Like, what do you see in that arena?
So what I see is young Democrats, like young people in general, are highly skeptical of big institutions. There's a study that came out showing that we're the most entrepreneurial generation in this country. We have the highest percentage of people in our generation who want to start businesses, start their own thing. And disproportionately, we're participating in the gig economy. So what that indicates to me is that millennials in general, and especially you see this among young Democrats, they want to see fully universal healthcare. They want to see education available to everyone. They want aggressive action on climate change. But I also don't think it's as simple as having the government take over everything on every issue. Because, we're the generation that inaugurated all of these peer-to-peer type solutions. Like, we like bottom-up solutions. And so I think when you have the socialist thing come up in the polling, I think there might be a definitional problem here, to be honest. I think...
What is your definition? How do you think socialists are perceived in a way that, I think especially in Trump's campaign, and I could see... people thinking of socialists and just picturing Bernie Sanders or something like that.
Yeah.
Who I would have had a hard time checking the ballot for this year, even against Trump.
Yeah. A friend of mine has this interesting theory that when millennials do kind of show up a bit more on these polls talking about kind of socialism, it's not so much the government taking over the means of production which would be more of a 20th century kind of definition of that term. Because think about it, which generation is most kind of individualistic and self-expressive and wanting to express our unique originality right. online?
Millennials, Gen Z.
That's going to be yeah. millennials and Gen yeah. Z. Like, we're trying to defy conformity. So that wouldn't seem to be consistent with this kind of socialist narrative. So I think there's more to it than that.
Yeah. It'll be fascinating to see how this all plays out in the next, 10, 20 years.
One thing I just got to say on that is I think part of the problem here, you feel like over and over again, this generation is trying to be forced into these existing boxes that exist. And I just think those boxes are quickly disintegrating before our eyes, because there is a combination of views here and an approach to politics that pollsters try and understand, but I just think they're getting it wrong. Because if you only look at politics on one dimension of a left to right dimension and now understand that there are other dimensions to it as well, then I think you're missing out on some of the key nuances of this generation.
Yeah, I agree 100%. Speaking of millennials, so record number of millennials won their races. So we're seeing some of that go into the Senate, right?
Yeah, I'm at all levels of government. So Millennial Action Project tracks millennials are running for Congress. And we saw a 266% increase of millennials who ran. There are about 72 millennials who, and Generation Z, there's I think one Gen Z who got elected, who will be taking office next year. And that's part of this huge youth surge, I think, that's now starting to get involved in government. And we saw this among voting as well. So, like I mentioned earlier, we were tracking this early vote and absentee voting trends. And we saw a 2.5 times increase of youth votes just in the early voting period compared to 2016. So, this is a massive shift that's underway, and I think that's going to have an impact on policy.
You talk about the massive shift on early voting. Do you think Trump hurt himself or shot himself in the foot by telling his base essentially not to vote early and kind of calling out ahead of time that those votes would be fraudulent or susceptible to fraud?
Yes, absolutely. And I'll explain why.
Do you think it cost him the election? I mean, it's relatively narrow right now.
It is narrow. That's an interesting question. I guess I would need to think more about that. But, you know, here's the thing. And here in Wisconsin, we've been voting absentee for decades and decades. And, you know, some absentee voting systems go as far back as the Civil War. So when you looked at the data on who uses absentee voting, prior to this election, you saw a pretty healthy uptake among both Democrats, Republicans, as well as independents. So when President Trump started sending out those tweets attacking absentee voting, I was talking to Wisconsin Republicans who said, well, we don't see any problem with absentee voting. And then later, Trump tried to make the distinction between whether you're mailing out ballots automatically or whether you request an absentee ballot. Whatever it is, the message was from President Trump, don't vote absentee. And I just think that probably did discourage some voters. And you know, again, it doesn't make any sense. You should want your voters to vote in the most secure and safe way that they see fit.
Yeah. Going back to some of these lawsuits, so President Trump is, you know, he's been constantly tweeting out throughout the week that he's leading by a lot. He hasn't conceded. We've gone over some of that. Is that, and a lot of these tweets are getting censored. And I'm curious to hear your take on, do you think it's right or wrong that those tweets are getting censored? And you see him doing that, and you see something like, a few days ago, I think it might have been last week, Wednesday or Thursday, Eric Trump, who's part of the campaign, and his son tweeted out a video of, it was like 50 or 80 ballots burning that it went back. It ended up being a doctored video by QAnon. But this is part of the campaign who's literally tweeting it out. And it got well over 1 million views, maybe close to 2 or 3 million views of just blatantly false information. Is that going to damage him in these lawsuits? That him and his campaign, or like even someone like Eric Trump, who's not him, but he's putting out that kind of information.
Well, it certainly underscores their credibility when they are making these allegations. And I think, look, we live in a new wild west of social media and political discourse. And the social media companies have been largely late to the game in trying to understand what do we do about this. And I do like now, you know, Twitter and Facebook too late, but still trying to experiment with different policies and approaches to try and have a fact-based political conversation. Each of these decisions have a potentially slippery slope. So they require a lot of deep thinking. And I think this was an election where I believe Twitter decided to even ban political advertisements leading up to the election?
Well, yeah, we actually run some political, we do a bunch of digital advertising here at GGMM, and you couldn't submit any new ads a week leading up to the election. You could before then, but nothing new could come leading up to the election is what they did. And you could keep those ads running that previously were submitted in running, but you couldn't submit any new ones.
Yeah, and I think it'll be really interesting to look back on this election and the behaviors of these different companies and see, you know, what worked and what didn't work. I think they probably don't know at this point. And so I think it's helpful to try some of these new techniques, because what we know is that the status quo is ultimately going to destroy our democracy. So we have to do something else that's going to try and promote a better political conversation. And I've been in touch recently with some of the heads of these social media companies who I think very genuinely do want to be part of the solution. And I've been encouraged by that, but it's too hard to tell right now what worked or what didn't work.
Do you think that the timing was too close to the election on this? It seems like these are more new things that have been rolled out that maybe could have been rolled out a year ago. Like even Trump, for example, who's, tweeting constantly, like
I was looking just the other day at his Twitter feed, and it's like every tweet has some kind of disclaimer.
Twitter literally won't get him a tweet out. He's probably brought the Twitter stock up so much over the last 4 years too. Like that is the reason why so many people spend time on Twitter, just to like see what he's tweeting and retweeting. And he's even admitted in some interviews, he's like, yeah, I don't know. I just hit the retweet button. You just retweet it. It's not my fault.
Yeah.
It's just like, President of the United States, you should probably like have a team behind you making sure, like monitoring your Twitter account. But yeah, he hasn't been able to get anything off in like the last week that Twitter hasn't shut down. They could have been doing this like 6 months ago, because it's not like his behavior's changed at all on Twitter, but it is, I find it humorous that, right during the election now is when they've chosen to censor him, but it probably would have been a better policy if they started that earlier.
Yeah.
I don't know if it would have changed anything or not, but
they're about 10 years late, so I'm glad they're starting, but again, you don't want to
How slippery of a slope is it to go down? Like, are they censoring any true information? Or obviously, like, the far right is basically claiming Twitter's just fake news now.
Yeah, well, I mean, while that critique is being made, Facebook publishes what are the most circulated Facebook posts, and almost always Donald Trump is in the top five. And I think in the past week, Trump was number one. And generally, other, Fox News and other conservative outlets are usually in the top 10. So there's a lot of, both conservative and liberal talking points are certainly getting a lot of traction. But look, I mean, the slippery slope arguments are something that, constitutional lawyers definitely need to look at, and just generally thought leaders and experts need to take some time thinking about, because, the question ultimately becomes who is deciding and based on what criteria. And sometimes the more blatant, fake news and more blatant kind of misleading tweets, that might be easier to censor, but there's a whole gray area where that's where it gets difficult. And you need some people who have really thought through the different scenarios. And, we were talking about Joe Rogan before the podcast, and he was making the point the other day that he generally believes that, more speech is better than less, and that more speech should try and correct the wrong speech that's out there. But, at the same time, the damage is done.
And it's hard it's hard because all speech is not equal, right or wrong. Yeah. Like Trump has 80 million Twitter followers. Yeah. What he says is going to be much more important and much more circulated than what you and I say.
And here's the thing. It's not just social media. Traditional media now sometimes gets it wrong because they try and be the first to report a headline instead of being the reporting it accurately.
Right, that's how they make money.
That's
how it's always been, right?
Yeah.
They're always trying to be first in a way. Do you think it's gotten any worse over the years just because it is so immediate and instant right now?
Exactly. I think it's gotten worse because of social media has amplified this by the second news reporting cycle, and I just think, sometimes I want to tell some news outlets just cool down for a little bit. Like, get the story right. You have a unique responsibility. And I feel like our local journalists have generally been outstanding. So but I think some of the national reporters sometimes really need to know that if they publish something that's false or misleading, social media will pick that up. And then if you do publish a correction, which is good that they do that, I've seen like the New York Times do that, the damage has already been done. So there needs to be a reckoning among the media. And you know, it's not surprising that generally the media is among the least liked institutions in our society today.
Yeah, it'll be amazing to see how that all plays out over the next several years as well. Looking forward, if Biden finally does make it into office and the election eventually gets conceded, tell me about his administration and what you see them doing. Are you looking forward to what they can do? What does he care about? What's he trying to get done?
So, first of all, in terms of building the administration, I think there are two different roads he can go down. And this is going to be very important to the success of the administration and the success of our country in general. Whenever an administration wins, you have a insider political class that's largely between New York and Washington, D.C., that kind of games the political appointment process. And so you often wonder, why is it that so many of the economic teams of both Republican and Democratic administrations tend to be run by Goldman Sachs and Wall Street? And you wonder, why is that? Meanwhile, Joe Biden spoke a lot to working class issues during the campaign. So here are the two scenarios. Does he staff his administration with some of the most entrenched and moneyed special interests, or does he choose to empower an administration from the working class and bring people in from the outside, from the Midwest, frankly, who can speak to some of those working class issues a bit more authentically? I just hope he can break out of that bubble. There is a bubble of political kind of appointees who just kind of go in this cycle. And so those are the two paths he could choose to go down.
Did Goldman donate a shitload of money to his campaign? Is that what always happens? Is these companies just donate massive amounts of money and then they're the ones who end up getting appointed? Obviously, that's how politics works, sadly, a lot. Do you have any insight to what's happened with the Biden administration and what direction he might be pursuing?
Yeah, I mean, you have both Wall Street that has a big influence on these campaigns, and you just look at their campaign finance reports and you see how much influence there is. But also, it's partly an access problem because often the people who, you know, now they're trying to build an administration very quickly. And so you're usually just hiring the people you can most immediately find who seem qualified to you. And they would argue that there's no time to kind of look outside of those circles and bubbles and truly bring in some new, fresh faces. And I think that's another problem that you have to deal with. It's you need to broaden the talent pipeline so you're getting some new voices in government. And then ideally, you're curbing the influence of money in these campaigns. I mean, this most recent campaign, I believe, was a $13 or $14 billion political cycle. You know, there's a lot of money there. And there's going to have, that helps to shape the types of people who are going into an administration. But one other key point here is that we're living in a pandemic, and you know, I'm very hopeful that the Biden administration would try and model a more competent response to this pandemic, but we will see.
Well, speaking of the pandemic, so news came out yesterday, Pfizer has a vaccine that's 90% successful. I don't know what the timetable is on when that'll hit public use. I don't know if you know that or not.
I think even if these trials are successful, then they would have to start the distribution next year. And I think based on what I've been seeing from experts, there would be an initial distribution, but for most of us as normal people, we wouldn't see it until maybe next summer.
Okay, got it. He says he's already forming a COVID task force. What do you know about that? And do you like the fact that he's come out with that? And then on the other hand, Trump campaign is saying it's a coincidence that the virus got announced right after the election. Do you think there's anything to that?
That one is, I really don't know. I mean, I've seen some crazy things happen behind the scenes. That one, I don't know.
Yeah, but you don't know.
You don't know. But in terms of the task force, yeah. I saw the list. Definitely highly, it seems like highly, you know, qualified group of people. Again, I would just ask with these types of task forces, we bring in a broader talent pipeline. And I'm not just talking about, you know, racial and ethnic diversity, which is hugely important, but also just diversity of background and, you know, more people from the Midwest. Get more people from the Midwest. That's really what I'm calling for here.
Yeah. And then the one last thing that I wanted to talk about with you as you were here. So right now, control of the Senate is kind of, it's up for grabs due to this runoff in Georgia, right? Like if the Democrats get both seats, they match the Republicans, and then Camilla's the tiebreaker as the vice president, right? Talk about, I wasn't familiar with what a runoff was. Do you just want to talk about what a runoff is and what the different scenarios that could happen here? This is going to be very interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. So in Georgia, the way they run their elections is that if no candidate reaches a majority of the votes, then they're going to move to a runoff election. So if you look at the Perdue-Ossoff race, for example, Perdue is just shy of a majority. I think he's like maybe 49.7 or something like that. So that triggers a runoff. The other one was easily a runoff. And
do any other states do this?
There are some other states. I believe Louisiana does it as well. I know there's some others. For the ranked choice voting wonks who are listening in, part of the idea with ranked choice voting is to condense that into one, what they call instant runoff, where if you rank the candidates, then you don't have to schedule another election. You already know what everyone's second, third, fourth choices are. So anyway, there are going to be two runoff elections early next year in Georgia. The balance of the Senate does hang on the result of those elections, and you're going to see an insane amount of money flowing into these races. And but you know, the idea is that the top two vote getters from this November election will be on the runoff ballot, and we'll see what happens.
Interesting. Any closing words? Anything we didn't cover that you want to get out there?
Well, I hope that we, you know, here, let me just say a couple kind of facts about the election and what that kind of means. So, you know, Biden, you know, clearly got a narrow majority in some of these key states like Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Arizona, et cetera. And I don't expect the recounts to really change anything. At the same time, Trump added to his vote total as well. So, you know, we live in a divided country, but in my view, those divisions are hyper-amplified by the media industrial complex. That's what I call it. And sometimes these most extreme voices drown out the community and commonality that we have as just human beings. And so my hope is that when we come out of this election, I hope we choose some of the things in our daily lives, as well as choices in our political system that can help us come out stronger, doing things like choosing to listen and have empathy for other people. And through that process, you might be able to find some common ground. Don't see our fellow Americans as the enemy, because if you see them as the enemy, then we go further into this kind of tribal type of dynamic. I think at the end of the day, there's been a lot of rhetoric about healing. And people need to know that healing is hard. Healing doesn't happen because it's said in a speech. Political cooperation doesn't happen because you say it needs to happen. These things happen because you have years and years of hard work, years and years of relationship building, trust building, listening, understanding, empathizing. And because you put in that hard work, that's what gives you the chance to reach a new solution together. And that's how I think our country will move forward.
Very, very well said. We'll end it there. Stephen, thanks so much for dropping by again.
Oh, thanks for having me. Always a pleasure to be here.
Absolutely. And just a reminder to everyone, if you could please write a review and subscribe if you have not already, that really helps us in the algorithm and gets more ears on great episodes like this. And just a reminder that this podcast is brought to you by Go Get It Marketing and Media, ggmm.io, and our good friends over at On Milwaukee. Thank you for joining us again today.